Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Just one guest today, the historian Quinn Slobodian, author of Globalists, The End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism from Harvard University Press. For a long time, I was a skeptic about the term neoliberalism. It seemed evasive, euphemizing, coming from a reluctance to, as they used to say, name the system, that is, capitalism. It was not unlike how people say unbridled or unfettered capitalism, as if they're trying to reassure themselves and others that they're reasonable moderates and not wild-eyed radicals. The term neoliberalism is tossed around sometimes as a reckless synonym for this crappy era we live in, without much more specificity than that. I changed my mind a couple of years ago about the term after reading Philip Murawski's Never Let a Good Crisis Go to Waste, and an important source for Murawski, Michel Foucault's lectures on neoliberalism. There are several important distinguishing features to the doctrine and movement, which it was. It never saw the market as spontaneous and self-regulating. Markets had to be created, nurtured, and protected from greedy workers, commies, and self-interested politicians. Its proponents understood, as Slobodian makes clear, that insulating the market from political interference required political action. And it had a view of individual humans as small businesses of some sort, developing their portfolio of human capital, were never citizens or workers. It's a worldview that is hostile to any notions of solidarity, except perhaps among neoliberals. While all this has something in common with classical liberalism, in the 19th century sense of small government laissez-faire, and homo economicus, it takes it several steps further. And sad to say, this has become the common sense of our time. You're on your own in this world, buddy. Blame public sector workers or baby boomers or Mexicans for your problems and never think of organizing politically to better your lot. Yes, these tendencies are always present, but they're far more intense and foregrounded now than they were before the early 1980s. Thankfully, there are signs we're moving beyond this way of thinking. There's certainly no shortage of books about neoliberalism these days, but Quinn Slobodian's is an especially fine example. It's comprehensive and very smart, reviewing the history of neoliberalism from its prehistory in the first decade of the 20th century, through its growth in the 1930s and 1940s, to its acquisition of political power in more recent decades. It's also a reminder that neoliberalism had a powerful influence before the names Thatcher and Reagan meant much. The early history of the European Union was shaped by neoliberal thought, as was the post-World War II German economic miracle. The role of the German branch, known as ordoliberalism, is often underplayed in Anglo-American analyses. GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and its successor, the World Trade Organization, were shaped by neoliberal economists and lawyers. GATT was, and the WTO is, headquartered in Geneva, a city that has been central to neoliberalism for a long time. The Mont Pelerin Society, an elite neoliberal think tank and agitational body, took its name from a resort on Lake Geneva, where it held its first meeting in 1947. Among the attendees of that inaugural meeting were the marquee names of the neoliberal movement, Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises, and Milton Friedman. In the interview, we didn't have time to address some important features of the book. One is the neoliberals' attitude towards race. Not all were racist, or at least more than the ordinary sort of racist, but some were. Some were quite fond of apartheid South Africa and the white regime in Rhodesia because they thought black Africans were unfit for the higher functions of capitalism. In that, they made an alliance with the American New Right, with figures like William F. Buckley and his colleagues around National Review, who not only found apartheid agreeable, but also supported segregation in the southern U.S. This aspect touches on the story of James Buchanan and the Virginia School of Neoliberalism that Nancy McLean wrote about in Democracy in Chains, a form of neoliberalism that was energized by school desegregation in the 1950s. Another aspect we didn't have time to get into was the importance of decolonization in the 1950s and 60s, the development of neoliberalism. For the race and decolonization aspects, you're going to have to read the book. Quinn Slobodian is an associate professor of history at Wellesley College. His earlier books are about Germany, East and West. He's also written for The Baffler. Quinn Slobodian. I have to admit at the start that I ended up being more impressed with the neoliberals than I was when I began reading it. I mean, I've been impressed by the depth and coherence of their view of the world, intellectual rigor. I mean, it doesn't make me any more feel any more warmly towards them politically, but it was quite an impressive school over the last century or so. What's your impression of them overall? I don't think you have a lot of political affinities with them either, but how do they stand up as antagonists?
Yeah, I mean, that mirrors kind of my own experience in writing the book in a way. I mean, I think I had a lot more of a reductive kind of understanding of how neoliberal thought worked when I started the book, just thinking of it as a kind of basically writing alibis for capital and producing sort of smoke screens for the, you know, realization of maximization of profit, exploitation of working class, et cetera, et cetera. And Hayek is well known for having this kind of like bewitching quality to his writing, which I'd only read about but hadn't experienced firsthand. And after delving into his work, I started to understand it a little more. And I saw that especially what Hayek is doing, he's kind of drawing on a lot of things that are happening around him, right? He's kind of an intellectual magpie in the sense that he sort of sees things, shiny objects that are happening intellectually, whether it's systems theory or cybernetics, and kind of folds them into his way of looking at the world. And I was definitely more impressed by the kind of the texture of their thought at the end than I was at the beginning. And I think that I was convinced more than anything by the time I was done that it's not helpful to think about neoliberalism as a kind of 12-point program to destroy the working class or a kind of recipe or orthodoxy, but as a kind of a way of asking a question, which is, you know, what does capitalism need right now to survive its own inherent tendency to self-destruct?
Well, they were concerned about the gravediggers that Marx wrote about, that you know, collectivism was on the march, and their view of the world was under siege, and they were quite consciously founded as a group to fight those tendencies, to plot over the longer term. I mean, I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but they were, to some degree, conspiring to defend this social system that they loved, especially in retrospect. They had a nostalgia for the world of the pre-World War I world, which many of them grew up in. It may not be a conspiracy to destroy the working class, but it was something of the order to limit its power.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Jamie Peck has this great line where he says, you know, there's conspiracy theories and then there's conspiracy facts. And it is certainly true that when these people, Hayek and Rupka and Mises, first got together in the 1930s, they saw the danger being sort of on the left and the right. So for sure, the fear of communism, for sure, asterisk, we could talk about it more, our concern about fascism. But the real fear was the one that outlasted the Second World War, which was the fear of social democracy, right? This idea of a kind of a Keynesian fix for capitalism's contradictions that could draw in people and sort of create a peace between workers and capitalists. And this is what they saw as being coming out of the Second World War. The real danger was the kind of the soft left, actually, was the danger, not the hard left or the right.
But they're also terrified of planning, whether we're talking about Soviet style or more Keynesian, softer style.
Mm-hmm. Yep, planning was a concern. But it's interesting. I mean, Hayek even goes out of his way to destigmatize that word by saying that, you know, in a way, we don't want to trash the idea of planning per se, because everyone makes plans in the sense that they operate on expectations about the future. So every entrepreneur does that. People do that. So they were actually pretty specific about what kind of planning they disliked. And obviously it was the model of nationalization and creating kind of targets for outputs of industries that were owned by the state, of the kind that was being done by the Soviet Union, yes, but also the UK and France after the Second World War.
Relevant to that idea of planning that they liked is that they did not believe that capitalism was a spontaneous order in itself. They certainly loved spontaneity within the capitalist order that they'd been setting up, but they believed it required institutions and rules to guide it. And this whole idea that they're all about getting the state out is exactly wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, that's sort of the biggest intervention, I guess, that I'm making in the book. I'm not the first one to make it, but there's a way in which critics of neoliberalism kind of get hoodwinked by the language of neoliberals themselves. So the sort of standard criticism of neoliberalism is, what an outrageous philosophy. There can't be any such thing as a self-regulating market. These people are obviously fools. But if you even read, you know, 10 pages of neoliberal theory, whether it's Buchanan or Hayek or Friedman, you see that they actually see the necessity of the state everywhere. So neoliberalism as a philosophy, and then certainly as a kind of a practice of government, is always about kind of re-engineering and retrofitting the state to better protect what they see as the space of competition and free enterprise, rather than doing away with the state altogether. And I think that's hopefully now something that critics of neoliberalism will just begin the conversation with realizing rather than needing to work through that again. I think that the idea of the self-regulating market, yes, it was in Smith to some extent, but that term really gets popularized by Polanyi, Karl Polanyi, who is a big critic, of course, of liberalism and a critic of some of these Austrians like Hayek and Mises. And people often take Polanyi's language as being reflective of what the neoliberals actually thought, whereas what I argue in the book is that people like Hayek and Mises were actually contemporaries of Polanyi in the sense that they all agreed that there wasn't such a thing as a self-regulating market and that there had to be a kind of a legal encasement of the space of the market for it to function. They just had different politics inside of that conception.
That touches upon an important distinction you bring forward at the beginning of the book from the former Nazi Carl Schmitt, a distinction between dominium and imperium. What's that mean and why is that important?
So in a book that Schmitt writes after the Second World War called The Nomos of the Earth, he talks about the project of the 19th century as one of separating the world into two spheres. One is the space of dominium, which is the sort of the rule of states. You can think about a category like sovereignty. So the territory of the world is divided up according to imperial and national sovereignties. And the other is the category of dominium, which is really the sphere of ownership. So you have on the one hand the sort of mosaic of fragmented territories, but then you have private property, which in the liberal imagination should apply everywhere regardless of jurisdiction or sovereignty. And for Schmitt, this was kind of an appalling fact that, you know, the rule of goods and property in the market should somehow transcend the control of national sovereignty. But for the neoliberals who were reading Schmitt and disagreeing with him in this case, they thought that this was actually kind of an ideal. This is precisely what they wanted, which is that you can have both political sovereignty, which separates up the world into this sort of jigsaw puzzle, but then you can have a sphere of property and ownership that is truly global and is not interfered with by the decisions of this or that government. So this really underpins, I mean, maybe just to then bring the point home, I mean, this really underpins their demand for the absolute right of the movement of capital over borders, for example, because this is supposed to happen in a kind of a domain and a realm that is separate from the realm of governments and democratic decision making and so on.
When neoliberalism reached its, jouissance in the 90s, when it reached its peak of popularity and success, there's a lot of loose talk about a borderless world, then where nation state was receding, and we achieved this world where national borders had become meaningless. Is that precisely the world the neoliberals dreamed of? Because you quote this guy from AEI as saying that we don't want a world without boundaries because we want exits. So what is their attitude towards the nation state?
Right. The starting point to try to understand any kind of philosophy of economic rule is to separate out for sure the question of the movement of people, capital, and goods, right? So migration, trade, and investment and finance are three very distinct categories. And in fact, the people I look at in the book treat these things differently throughout the 20th century, and they don't have a single attitude towards all three, and they certainly don't, by the end of the 20th century, come down on the idea that there should be, you know, no borders, full stop. In fact, the thing that intervenes first is the idea that there does need to be some regulation of the movement of people over borders. So already by the 1930s, people I write about in the book are coming up with theories of free trade, according to which if you have enough movement of capital and enough free trade, then you don't need to have free migration because you can still take advantage of a kind of open world economy. And by the 1970s, people like Hayek are actually saying this isn't just a kind of a nod to sensibilities of the masses, but this is actually based on the idea that some cultures have an aptitude for market activity that others don't. And it makes sense to sort of circumscribe the space of market activity to those people of cultural backgrounds and maybe even racial backgrounds who know how to act well as market actors, and you don't want to let in a flood of people who don't, because then they actually end up becoming, you know, drains on the welfare state, and they kind of end up becoming cheerleaders for a kind of socialism that throws the right-wing market economy off of its tracks. I think that the idea that neoliberalism is a dream of a world without borders is a pretty decontextualized one. I mean, that's not really something that maps onto the intellectual history of people who have actually been thinking through this over the last 7 decades. I think that becomes a kind of a foil for this right-wing backlash, right? That I think it willfully misunderstands what neoliberal globalism has actually been about.
I'm speaking with Quinn Slobodian, Associate Professor of History at Wellesley and author of Globalists, The End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism from Harvard University Press. You bring forward something, and I saw this in Hayek before, that I find as a socialist and internationalist quite disturbing, because they are deeply cosmopolitan and don't have much patience for nationalism. And they make the argument that socialism and social democracy are by their very nature nationalistic. And as a socialist and an internationalist, I have to think about how to reconcile these things. Can they be reconciled, or do they have a very serious point there?
Well, I mean, I would say two things. One, I just wrote about an article about this, and it's in the book as well. It really focuses in on Mises as a German Jew in the Habsburg Empire, you know, raised in the Polish-speaking part of the Habsburg Empire in Lvov, you know, grew up speaking French, Polish, some Ukrainian, and German, and in a time when there's more and more national sentiment, and moved to Vienna, and in Vienna, which is the heartland of kind of the liberal Jewish intelligentsia, you know, he shared this perspective that nationalism would be suicide for him because there were no place for Jews in the kind of emergent nationalist imaginary that was happening at the time. So he was driven to, in a way, structurally, a kind of cosmopolitanism or anti-nationalism, which then, you know, paradoxically became a pro-imperialism because it seemed like the Habsburg Empire was the only thing that was able to contain the, you know, the energies of nationalism. But, you know, he was kind of an oddball in that sense. Yes, there were some German Jews who turned to free market liberalism in the flight from nationalism, but many more turned to socialism. Right? I mean, socialist cosmopolitanism is a well-defined position that we have to think about as emerging out of the same moment that this neoliberal thought position came out of. And they're both ways of sort of thinking universalistically and sort of opposing nationalist tendencies. But it doesn't follow to me that, you know, the fact that the neoliberals were against nationalism makes them sort of the monopolist of the only position outside of nationalism that exists. But I think it does help to think about, you know, what the actual decisions that were being made at the time kind of entailed politically.
But the space for either redistribution or more aggressive planning, the nation makes a very convenient boundary for that kind of space. It's kind of hard to think about how to make that in a post or non-nationalist way.
I suppose, but I mean, there have been, you know, pretty well-known large-scale attempts. I mean, if you think about the Bretton Woods order after 1944, the creation of the World Bank and the creation of this sort of financial regulatory authority that would have worldwide jurisdiction, the IMF, which was set up not originally to kind of, you know, shrink everyone's social states and enforce kind of free capital movements, but quite the opposite, to help states build up their social sector and regulate free capital movements. That's how the IMF worked for the first 3 decades of its life, from the 40s to the 70s. Then these are, you know, colossal kind of world scale projects of planning. They are not full throated kind of projects of redistribution, but they have had moments where the door was open towards those. And that's something I cover in the book as well, the 1970s. A period of the new international economic order, which has been revisited by a series of historians recently, including Sam Moyne, who was on your show recently. This was a moment where, in fact, there was attempts to think through a kind of world-level planning, and they ended up being defeated, but they were there, and it was not a kind of a laughable thing. This is something that Nobel Prize winners like Jan Tinbergen were heavily involved with. Vasily Leontief, one of the fathers of macroeconomics, was there trying to make a world plan, right? This is what I hope the book does. I mean, yes, it is primarily a kind of intellectual genealogy of neoliberal thought, but what I try to do in every chapter from the 30s to the 90s is to show that, to work kind of in counterpoint, to show that neoliberalism was always emerging in the perception of a threat from the left And so I try to give a kind of an impression of what the strong demands were being made for more economic oversight and economic redistribution, against which the neoliberals always were responding.
There are some people who reject the term entirely, that neoliberalism is just a fancy word for capitalism. It's always been pretty much the same, you know, with minor modifications over time, and the whole terminology is misleading. What is gained by using the term? What does it mean exactly?
Well, I think it's helpful to think about the way it's used first, and it kind of gets used in, let's say, three different ways. One is, and this tends to be the way that Marxists or someone like David Harvey uses it, is to describe a kind of a period of time, right? So starting in the 1970s, we entered into an era of neoliberalism, which is a way of describing an epoch of global capitalism. Another way it's used is to describe a kind of a relationship that people have to themselves and others. So this is more of the Foucault-inspired Wendy Brown-style understanding of what neoliberalism is, which is, you know, we see ourselves as bundles of human capital, which we need to maximize, and we, you know, treat everyone around us as just, you know, opportunities for, like, speculation on our own value and ways to maximize our own utility. And there's a third way, which is the way I use it, which is as a discrete intellectual tradition, the same way you would talk about, you know, let's say the Frankfurt School of cultural Marxist thought, or anarchism or classical liberalism. Neoliberalism is a discussion among a fairly discrete group of people that began in the 1930s, and the premise of which was laissez-faire doesn't work anymore. Capitalism actually needs more assertive methods to secure its own reproduction.
You quote someone saying that laissez-faire really is just a surrender to the status quo.
Yeah, I mean, that's their attitude would be more like laissez-faire will lead to violent reactions which will undermine the very basis of the market. I see neoliberalism as a school of thought associated with people around the Mont Pelerin Society, you know, self-consciously connecting themselves to a lineage of people from Friedrich Hayek through Mises through Friedman through Stiegler and Becker and so on. It takes very seriously the threats to capitalism. And it sees them self-consciously as things that need to be, you know, approached and dealt with kind of in turn. So it's not Pollyanna-ish or a Whiggish approach to social order at all. Actually, neoliberal thought is characterized by a sort of a constant terror of its own, you know, imminent demise of the market that always needs to be shored up and always needs to be protected by the kind of the always sort of surging hordes of the masses, the people who will seek to undermine it and seek to turn the state into a mechanism of reproduction, right? So if you look at neoliberalism as a kind of intellectual project, which is the way that I primarily look at it, as a kind of a lens onto the problems of capitalism, which I see as being distinct from neoliberalism, then it can be simply it can be a helpful way to think about the political alternatives that have been thrown up and thrown out over the decades, the same way that looking at the history of socialist thought or Marxist thought can be a useful way to say sort of what paths were intellectually tried out, how did they square up with reality, how were they discarded. And for me, talking about this really discrete intellectual tradition as neoliberalism is only sensible. I don't know what other term one could use to describe it.
That was the first part of my interview with Quinn Slobodian, an associate professor of history at Wellesley and author of Globalists, The End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism, from Harvard University Press. You listen to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Thank you. That was some of the Bourrée from Bach's English Suite No. 1, performed by András Schiff. And now on to the second part of my interview with Quinn Slobodian, author of Globalists, The End of Empire, and the Birth of Neoliberalism, from Harvard University Press. You take the origins of neoliberalism back a little further than most people do, though, you know, as opposed to the 1947 Mont-Pelerin Society meeting or, you know, the 1930s you were just talking about. Back to 1907, the Vienna Chamber of Commerce. What's that angle?
Most of the time, you're exactly right. Well, neoliberalism is usually nowadays placed as kind of coming out of the Great Depression. So there's this famous gathering in Paris in 1938 when Ripka and Hayek were excited about Walter Lippmann's recently produced book, The Good Society, and brought him to Paris, and they had a discussion along the lines of how do we save the market from its enemies on left and right? Fascists and socialists both want to undermine, you know, kind of the free market, and how can we defend it? I think that that is only misleading insofar as it makes the problem of neoliberalism appear to be one that is kind of domestic or local or national at the largest. And by looking at Mises and Hayek within the space of the Habsburg Empire, I think you see what has been not well described before, which is that neoliberalism actually has a strong heritage as a kind of a critique of national sovereignty. That actually the problem of protecting the economic order is a world level problem. It's not a national level problem. In fact, the nation is part of the problem. That the kind of the urgency and the moral urgency that is behind a lot of the neoliberal movement is this feeling that they need to kind of rescue the whole. They need to rescue the totality. And that literally the kind of the fate of the world, not just the fate of the nation or the fate of this or that class is at stake, but the entire system itself needs to be sort of saved. And interestingly, for me anyway, the way that that gets articulated is not, we want to save the world and thereby make the world a better place, quote unquote, or make everyone's lives better. Not really. It's really a kind of ideology of the lesser evil, which is to say, we need to save the world from being destroyed by its enemies. And if we save it, there's going to be inequality, and there's going to be things that people see as injustice, and there is going to be suffering, but it won't be as bad as the alternative. I mean, that is the kind of cold, you know, message of neoliberalism at the end of the day, is like, it's not as bad as the options that are otherwise circular.
Yeah, I mean, what is their goal? What motivates them? What is their, you know, the vision of happiness at the end of the neoliberal road? Of course, you know, the idea of a road is itself problematic, as you point out, but what drives them? I mean, and like inequality. I mean, is inequality just an unfortunate byproduct of the market world they imagine, or is it rewards for contributions to society? Like, how does all that shake out?
It's a necessary byproduct of the world they imagine, right? I mean, without the differential kind of rewards being granted for new discoveries and innovations, then why would people do it, right? I mean, so you need to have inequality so that people will be driven to, you know, elevate themselves above others and, you know, experience kind of material rewards that come along with exertion. So that, I mean, that in itself is kind of a very old, and that's very much a kind of a Victorian liberal idea, right? The way that the market should drive us all to sort of self-motivation and self-help. But I think the neoliberal aspect of it, and this is where it's for me very helpful to look at the way that Hayek talks about systems theory, and sort of incorporates almost these metaphors from biology and physics into his line of thinking, is that it is a belief that that the system itself must survive, and that if the system, there's a way in which individual freedom is kind of instrumentalized to save the whole. And this is very clear in some of the passages I quote in the book from Hayek, where what he's strongly implying is that individual freedom is not an end in and of itself. We are granted a space of individual freedom within the social order so that we can do the things that will allow the social order to reproduce itself. And the way that you measure that success is actually quite difficult, right? It's not in the mind of someone like Hayek, rising GDP. It's not because he didn't believe in GDP. It's not per capita income. It's not how many dollars a day the world lives on. These things are irrelevant to him. Mises and Hayek and other Austrians are strong critics of the quantifying aspect of economics, so the idea that you can have this kind of oversight. The only quantitative indicator he grants in his last work is the number of lives on the human planet. So he says capitalism is the best system, and we know that because capitalist societies have produced more bodies on Earth than other systems. And other systems have not been able to, you know, produce this kind of reproductive fecundity that capitalism has ensured. And if we move to socialism, then all we will do is ensure the deaths of hundreds of millions of billions of people on this earth. So he kind of holds hostage the world's population, literally, to, you know, the threat of anything other than the free market capitalism he desires.
What was the point of it? Do they tell stories about maximizing the sum of human happiness?
No. I mean, that's not also a category that would be helpful. Mises does have a kind of utilitarian strain in him, which Hayek himself criticized quite a bit. But I really think that even the question of consumer freedom, which I've just read in a very interesting book by Nicholas Olson about the idea of consumer sovereignty, and what he makes clear is that even the idea of, you know, being free to choose in the kind of Milton Friedman sense is not an end in itself, right? We are free to choose insofar as our choices end up sort of maximizing the likelihood of the reproduction of the system. And it all sounds so lowest common denominator as a kind of a political utopia, as you seem to be, you know, picking up on. But try living through two world wars, right? I mean, that's where this becomes important, the fact that they saw their homes and their lives devastated twice, you know, in a generation. Then you start to understand a kind of like minimum utopia, right? Which I think that might be a good way of describing what the neoliberals are demanding, as a kind of a minimal utopia.
Yeah, it also sounds like a bit like an anthill, though. Just like large numbers of creatures running around producing. But to what end?
Well, I mean, this is the threat of kind of systems thinking, and that would just be something you would apply to someone like Hayek, but it would also be applied to, you know, ecological thinkers and stuff too. I mean, a lot of the problems of using analogies between humans and the natural world runs into that. And I think that, I mean, they were riffing off, I mean, Hayek was riffing off of E.O. Wilson in the 1970s, right? He saw him as someone whose ideas of sociobiology were both inspiring but also wrongheaded, because Hayek wanted to say it wasn't just genes, it was also culture that was doing the transmitting. But the perspective of the totality is something that is really recurrent. And in my reading of the commentary on neoliberalism was really missing, right? I think that the same way you kind of get hoodwinked if you think that neoliberals believe in the self-regulating market, full stop, you also kind of get hoodwinked if you think that neoliberals just quote unquote believe in individual freedom, full stop. I think that's true, but it's missing the second clause, right? If they believe in individual freedom as a means of preventing the destruction of the system as a whole.
Yeah, freedom is a means, not an end, then.
That's my argument. Yeah. I mean, I think that there's, you can pick and choose quotations, especially from someone like Friedman, from Friedman, who would suggest otherwise. You know, there is a way in which it gets rhetorically discussed as an end in itself. But I think that if you try to put it together as a kind of a coherent worldview, these things fade away as ends in themselves and become kind of means to the end of the total system. I think which is another way of saying that, you know, the ideal for them is that it's both, right? That it's in both an end in itself and it does this thing for the system as a whole. I mean, that's what they're seeking. It's a way in which people can have an impression of, you know, a full unfolding of their personality. But the way in which their personality is unfolding is, you know, directed in the particular kind of a way that does not disrupt the functioning of the market mechanism. So if you decide that you want to unfold your personality by, you know, creating equality in your neighborhood or in your nation or in the world level, and you want to do that by, you know, getting into the streets and getting together with people with like-minded ideas, then that wouldn't be the kind of individual freedom they had in mind.
You mentioned Hayek's contempt for the concept of GDP, and I believe you quote him saying that he wished he'd rued not having written a critique of Milton Friedman. His idea of positive economics, you know, his use of statistics and trying to turn economics into a real science of some sort. Yeah, the economy is sublime. It's like beyond human understanding. That's just a fascinating concept. Like, what is our relation to this sublime object of, you know, in classic aesthetic theory, one is the attitude towards the sublime is one of awe and surrender and fear that it could destroy you. Is that what the economy means to someone like Hayek?
I think it does. I mean, the other thing I really hope that the book does is to kind of stop people from conflating neoliberalism with economism, right? But then this happens quite a bit. And I think by economism, people often mean, you know, disbelief that a single number like GDP, you know, tells us enough about policy that we should only orient ourselves towards it. But in fact, this is a chapter in the book, the 1930s was a period where Hayek sort of saw the emergence of national income accounting and the rise of things like GDP. And he kind of ran away screaming because he saw that this was going to be a tool of the planners, of the social democrats, and of the redistributionists. It could be a way to sort of calculate, you know, individual income and contribution to the economy in a way that could lead to movements towards evenness and equality rather than what he wanted. So
he was not incorrect in that perception, right? I mean, Leontief was a planner, you know, they were trying to plan the war, get out of the depression. So he was correct that that kind of statistical apparatus was at least some kind of planning effort.
Absolutely, he was, right. Tinbergen, who does one of the first national income accounts, is the very Tinbergen who in the 1970s is trying to figure out how to, you know, reduce inequality in the global south by international planning mechanisms. So he was dead on. I mean, which is why I want to keep those two things separate, because I think that the progressive position on economics as a discipline is often, I think, short circuits too quickly to it being a kind of handmaiden of neoliberalism. And I think that, you know, you'll find a lot of very interesting economists out there, whether it's the people at, you know, the Roosevelt Institute, who I'm sure have been on your show before, Marshall Steinbaum and J.W. Mason and Mariana Mazzucato now. People like that are doing great stuff with the discipline of economics. So we don't want to throw that away as a potential ally. So that's important. But what you see with this relationship of the sublime, the way that I'm talking about it there is indeed, it must remain unnameable. I mean, Hayek said that, you know, he resented the idea of people talking about the economy like it's a thing, right? Because as soon as you see it as a thing, you can then seek to engineer it or modify it. If you see it as the catalaxy, which his preferred term is, right, which is almost intentionally kind of mystical, I mean, it is intentionally mystical, then all you can do is kind of create the institutions around it that can kind of enframe it or encase it, as I talk about, without ever trying to sort of look at the thing itself, right? So that's why their big emphasis on law is so important, because they're trying to say, how can we sort of tiptoe around this magical object called the market without actually saying what the market is? Because the moment we try to say what it is, we open the possibility of sort of engineering it for the purposes of social justice or economic equality, which is the last thing in the world we want.
But he wouldn't have been one to trade national income accounting for happiness accounting.
Well, see, that's a very good case in point. So Will Davies has written a whole book about the sort of the happiness industry, and that falls clearly into that zone of kind of managerial neoliberalism, right? Which is like new indicators can be good ways to kind of produce economic efficiency. But that's totally antithetical to the Austrian school Hayekian understanding of how market policy should work.
I'm speaking with Quinn Slobodian, an associate professor of history at Wellesley and author of Globalists, The End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism from Harvard University Press. And when we're talking about neoliberalism, there's an institution very much in the news, the EU, which the neoliberals have had an ambivalent relationship with. On the one hand, it was an internal space within the membership of the kind of vision of law that they viewed as fostering their ideal kind of economy. On the other hand, it was carved off from the rest of the world, Fortress Europe, outside the European walls, not very neoliberal relations with the outside world. So the question, you know, around the EU now is it a fundamentally neoliberal institution that cannot be reformed, or what? Is it really a fundamentally a neoliberal institution?
No, I would say. I mean, I'm a historian, though, so I don't really believe in the things being fundamentally in their essences locked into certain things in ways that can never be contested or changed, because that's not how history is work. I mean, anything that has been created out of kind of collective action has transformed over the course of its lifespan, you know, moved in different directions. And the EU is the perfect case of a kind of a, you know, an extraordinary collective project that was combining people with many different intentions and motivations from the moment of its creation, right? And that's also what I cover in a chapter of the book, is how half the neoliberals were like, this thing is ridiculous. It's like a project of agricultural protectionism. It's about scaling up sort of bureaucracy to, you know, create a socialist superstate. And the other half were like, no, this thing is great. This is giving a way to basically penetrate national sovereignty and enforce, you know, what became the four freedoms of capital, labor, services, and goods. So we're in the same position now. I mean, I think it since the 90s, since Maastricht, in a way, it has been pushed more towards an austerity project of enforcing these absurd constitutional limits on deficits and so on. But the 90s was also the time of a discussion of social Europe, against which the neoliberals responded strongly. There was a fear that Jacques Delors was going to turn this in a way to into a thing to kind of harmonize labor relations and harmonize transfers between states in a way that was going to lead to greater equality and greater workers' rights. It didn't turn out that way, obviously. But talk about the height of kind of defeatism to sort of say like, well, you know, it's been 15 years and this is the way it's turned into. This is what it's turned into. Therefore, it is in essence this and must be discarded entirely. I mean, that's a counterproductive way to look at history and politics, I think. It needs to be seen as an open space of contestation from its very beginning with the stack, you know, the deck stacked against certain outcomes, but the deck is always stacked against progressive outcomes, right? It's always just a question of the right mobilization and the right set of enchainment of people's interests in a way that will change what appear like a defeated position.
That's music to my ears, but perhaps not to everyone's. One aspect of the EU structure, though, that is deeply neoliberal is that they try to insulate a whole lot of important decision-making around economic matters in particular from popular influence. And the role of expertise in judicial bodies and regulatory bodies is very strong. Parliament weak, you know, the European Court of Justice is strong. Talk about how that is really so much a part of the neoliberal vision, that kind of insulation of so much of social life from democratic influence.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this ahead of talking to you, and I think that if you will pardon like a slight lengthy kind of scholarly moment here, that I was thinking that there's kind of three forms of neoliberalism that we see right now that I think it's helpful to distinguish. And this is coming out of also reading the work of the sociologist Stephanie Mudge, who's just written this big, important book about how supposedly left parties like the German SPD and the late and UK Labour and the US Democratic Party all embraced, you know, what seemed like can only be called neoliberal positions in the 1990s. So she's just like, how did this happen? And I think that that is a particular kind of neoliberalism, which can be thought of as kind of managerial or technocratic neoliberalism, right? Which is like, there's a basic suspicion of the population and a basic suspicion of the policymakers as just kind of tending to always want free stuff. So you kind of need to hail them as customers or as consumers. You need to hail citizens as customers in a way that they will perform this kind of continual audit on the state itself, right? They'll express preferences, they'll economize, they'll suggest downgrade and benchmark and rate and all of these things. And it's a kind of a technocratic logic that has, you know, become not just part of our relationship to the state, but our relationship to everything, right? You can't take a flight without being asked to like rate the flight after you've taken the flight. This is now part of the contract of engaging in any kind of service relationship. So that is alive and strong and is kind of third wayism at its finest. But it kind of needs to be thought of as one kind of neoliberalism. Next, you have what I think of as constitutional neoliberalism, which is this idea that, yes, the people are untrustworthy. They tend to want free stuff. Therefore, you need to hive off and insulate certain aspects of state decision making from popular pressures, right? So whether that's central bank independence or the European Court of Justice or the creation of investor state dispute settlement bodies to regulate and enforce free trade mechanisms. So the European Commission, the things you're describing are very much along that line, right? The European Central Bank acts as a kind of a constitutionally created body that is forced to hold the line against any attempts to kind of create an expansionary social state in one of the member states, and et cetera. So that's really bound to not the logic of sort of management and auditing and ratings, but the logic of law. And it's easy to depict that as a kind of iron cage, right? And it gets done all the time, right? The EU is described as kind of the just like the German iron cage that's been imposed on the member states. But again, history just shows us, and not even very distant history shows us, that this cage's bars are far from iron. From the beginning, France and Germany were breaking the rules on the deficits. Recently, you know, it's coming from the right, but the Italian government under Matteo Salvini has managed to make the EU bend on its supposed limits on deficits. So this apparent iron cage is actually, you know, another space of kind of contestation and struggle. The third kind of neoliberalism is the one that comes back to your question about migration. And that is this sort of ascendant, what you could see of as kind of a culturalist or racialist, or what I'm thinking of as a kind of homeland neoliberalism, right? Which is actually really opposed to locked in multilateral institutions like the European Union, let alone the WTO, and argues that capitalism can be best protected by actually opting out of all of these binding treaties and acting through the kind of decisionism of, you know, of a Trump, of a Salvini, of a would-be alternative for Germany government. And this is a kind of a fusion of free market principles with a culturally essentialist understanding of, you know, some humans being good economic actors and others being bad economic actors. And it deviates from the supposed universalism of neoliberalism because it says, no, the same rules don't work everywhere. The same auditing mechanisms don't work everywhere. You know, some populations are different. This are three competing and sometimes overlapping models of what neoliberalism looks like right now. And all of them have their own intellectual history. They've all been explicitly thought through over the decades. And that's, I think, the project right now is to save the analytic clarity of neoliberalism by being specific about what we're talking about when we use that term.
So is the beast dead? I mean, it's been pronounced dead now, starting with the death of Lehman Brothers, then, you know, the election of Trump, Brexit, you know, the rise of right-wing parties in Eastern Europe. Is neoliberalism dead, or is it just regrouping?
Oh, I think it's not dead. I mean, I have some friends who are working on a book right now called Mutant Neoliberalism. And they are using that term because neoliberalism has been pronounced dead for decades, right? Since the 90s. I have a reference to this somewhere. When Clinton was elected, people were pronouncing neoliberalism dead, right? And so it happens with regularity. You can count with a whole. And so what people say is it's dead, but it's still here. Therefore, it must be a zombie. That's the way that people tend to talk about it. But these friends of mine, Will Callison and Zach Manfredi, both of who are working out of Berkeley, actually, they say, no, we need to think of it as a mutation, not as a kind of a walking dead specter. What neoliberalism, and this is not using it, this is when you think about the actual people who are thinking through the problem explicitly, as I said, they say, you know, when circumstances change, so do we. And if you look at the Alternative for Germany party or the Austrian Freedom Party, which would be part of what you're describing as a kind of like a right-wing backlash against the neoliberalism we had before. You know, many of the leading people in the Alternative for Germany Party are part of the Friedrich Hayek Society. The Alternative for Germany Party was started by economists who were opposed to the introduction of the euro, and they believe that what Germany needs is to kind of break from the socialism of the fiat money being produced in Frankfurt at the European Central Bank and return to, you know, strictly enforced austerity rules. And some of them are, one of their Bundestag members sitting in parliament is a gold consultant and an active gold bug who believes that fiat money itself is like the road to socialism. So we need to return to, you know, hard money of precious metals. So when I look at parties, you know, filled with people who are self-identifying, you know, libertarians and adherents of ordo-liberalism, I don't see a kind of rejection or a backlash even against neoliberalism. I see a new form of it. That requires us to be more specific about what we mean when we say neoliberalism, so it doesn't all get just blobbed together into one big, you know, moving morass of evil or something. You do need to be specific, and I think the way that the Koch brothers try to exert influence on the American democratic process is actually different from the way that the Alternative for Germany party tries to exert influence. There is a difference between trying to push a balanced budget amendment into the U.S. Constitution versus drumming up support for xenophobic policies by saying that, you know, Turks have low IQs or are unable to operate well within the market. But they are coming out of two kind of shades of neoliberal thought.
I was Quinn Slobodian, Associate Professor of History at Wellesley and author of Globalists, The End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism from Harvard University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this song of Stop Believing by Cheekface, a band about which I know nothing except that they're from L.A., and you can find this song on Bandcamp and SoundCloud. Till next week, bye.
I may be too fat to be Spider-Man, but not to be body-positive Spider-Man. All day I dream about self-improvement, capitalism, deregulation, and eating a bagel. Thanks for the invite, but I'm too non-going.